Today I'm in Minehead with Justin Briney, who works on Premier Radio.
Started with the breakfast show, and I was on part of the team as a co-host, really well. Learned the ropes, really, and then became a co-host of the breakfast show, and then began my own show, which is still going today. Unbelievable. With a question mark. That's what it's called.
Yeah. Yeah, it's great to be here. I'm going to ask you some questions, and we're going to talk. And you are drinking coffee, not tea.
I am.
So I'm going to start.
You're going to have to rename this one 100 cups of tea and coffee.
Well, interestingly, Bishop Lee only drinks coffee as well. It's only me that has to compulsorily drink tea in this. So the first question then is, do you ever drink tea?
Oh, yes, yes. But my wife converted me to Earl Grey early on in our relationship.
Right.
So I do like a cup of Earl Grey. But I'm very happy with regular tea as well. But if I had the choice, I'd tend to go for Earl Grey over any other brand.
It's very strange. I'm doing this thing of interviewing someone who is much better at the technology than I am. So just anxiously looking at the levels here.
It looks all right to me. Looks like we're all coming through quite nicely there.
Okay. So you would now say that Earl Grey is your favourite cup of tea?
Yes, yes, I would. I don't tend to go in for sort of ginger and green tea and all that sort of herbal tea stuff. Never really gotten into that.
Mm-hmm.
Always take milk, don't take sugar. And so there are some people who are Earl Grey snobs who say you shouldn't have milk in Earl Grey.
Mm.
But I don't agree with that. I just think I'm quite happy with my milk.
My understanding is that the Queen drinks Earl Grey with
milk.
Is
that right?
I don't know for certain whether that's true or not. But
well, if it's good enough for the Queen, it's good enough for me.
That's what I heard.
Yeah.
I did once have a cup of tea with the British ambassador in Belarus a long time ago.
Wow.
And the tea was brought out and then we had to put our milk in if we wanted it. He was a very interesting man. So the tea, you do sometimes drink tea, because Bishop Lee said that he really doesn't like tea. He would always choose coffee,
really?
But he's still allowed to be in the tea drinking project. He's still allowed. So how do you respond to the statement that Christianity in the UK is not dying but sleeping?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth in that. Because I think actually there's an assumption that people have lost their belief or their belief in the spiritual. And actually I think, you know, if I sat in a cafe not long ago and was just listening, eavesdropping really, on some of the conversations going around me. And I was surprised at how many took a spiritual direction or turn. And I think it's wrong to say that people have sort of given up on the whole idea of God or spirituality. I think what people have become wary of or has become passé to some extent is organised religion. And so I think people have an idea of what church is and they think of it as stuffy or, you know, old-fashioned, irrelevant maybe, something that's, you know, part of the history of the UK but not the present. And from that point of view, I think there's a sense in which there's a conception of the church. But I have a feeling that actually people are still asking the same spiritual question they've always asked. And the church can actually provide the same answers for a modern generation. So I think, yeah, I don't think Christianity is dying. I think I would be more inclined to say it's asleep. And that actually we've gone through similar cycles in the history of this country where we've had revivals followed by a kind of institutionalization almost of that faith, so that over a couple of generations what the grandparents experienced is no longer sort of the living reality of their the next generation, and you drift into nominalism. But then before too long, hey, another, you know, Wesley or Whitfield or whatever comes along and suddenly we see suddenly something happening again. So I meet a lot of atheists in what I do with my radio show, and a lot of them sort of are always prophesying the death of the Christian church because of the latest statistics or survey or whatever has come out. And I often think, well, it's a bit short-sighted, because you go back and there's always been this tendency for things to dip down, but it's always come back again, interestingly. So why would you assume that that's not going to happen this time? And I also get to see a lot of really interesting green shoots of what I would see as sort of spiritual revival among lots of churches in the UK, not least the Anglican Church in various areas, which I think are maybe the first signs of actually God's doing something, and the sleeping giant perhaps will arise again.
One of the reasons that I'm doing this project is because the evidence from where I minister is contradictory.
Mm.
So our Sunday morning numbers are going down.
Right.
They went up when I first arrived in Box, and then they've been going down Sunday mornings. But our other attendances are going up. But also, there's a huge fringe for us. And when I say huge fringe, I mean that in the Christmas period, so the 24 hours, 36 hours around Christmas, a third of our population will come to church.
Yeah, it's crazy, isn't it?
And that is not death.
Mm.
But I'm not sure it's life either. But that's the kind of contradictory thing, because if in one of my villages of 3,000, 1,000 people want to come to church in sort of in the run up to Christmas, if it was dead, they wouldn't come.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I think Christmas for whatever reason, I guess there's a bit of nostalgia. There's the sense of still at least at some level, Christmas still has in culture the trappings of the original story that it's based on. I think it is a gift still to the church, and it's interesting to see. It's interesting that I often again talk to non-Christians and atheists who say, "Well, I'm not a churchgoer, but I love coming along to a carol service. I love, you know, it's something about the atmosphere, the music. I think where it takes them emotionally, and that's just a really interesting phenomenon, isn't it? And I think it is. It as you say, it doesn't mean that somehow revival is just around the corner, or that there's, you know, all these people are really just secret believers or anything like that. But I think it does say something about the fact that people still want more than just the commercialism of that season. They want to connect with something that means more, that kind of puts it in a bigger story, in a bigger context. So I think it's brilliant that, you know, I think a lot of churches have woken up to the fact that this is an amazing opportunity every year, when people are more willing to come to church than at any other time of the year, and churches are starting to kind of, I think, capitalise on that and try to engage people in a way that actually encourages them to think about church in a bigger vision, in a big long term. But I'd agree, it's hard, isn't it? How do you convert that, whatever that feeling is, into something that's actually about introducing people to the bigger story, not just the baby Jesus, but the grown-up Jesus?
Yeah.
That's the challenge for every vicar or minister, isn't it?
Yeah, in my Easter sermons this year, I used a poem by Steve Turner called "The Cost of Christmas Reassembles for Easter." And it's a really good poem, and it's about that whole kind of moving people on from the baby Jesus. And the last line is, "This way, baby Jesus, my, how you've grown."
I mean, in our church context, my wife's a minister of a United Reformed Church, and it was the first, she went into training more or less straight out of university, having done a theology degree. So we were both very young, really, when we began at this church, 24, and she's been there 12 years now. And it's been a really good experience, actually, because we inherited a fairly elderly congregation in some ways, predominantly in the more elderly sort of category. And we've seen a lot of younger families and children and so on, so that it's much more of a multi-generational kind of community now, the church. And it's been growing, and that's fantastic, and there's been lots of stuff along the way that's helped with that. But we also see this, the Christmas factor, you know. We do a donkey service on Christmas Eve every year, about 3:30 in the afternoon, just as it's kind of the lights going. and everyone gathers outside, and we get so many people from the local community who don't show up to church in the rest of the year, but they come out for that service, and they say it's because they really want to do something meaningful with their kids before all the presents and everything goes crazy. You know, they really like having something that kind of brings the meaning of Christmas home. And it's very informal and fun, and you know, we sing songs and carols. It's all slightly, you know, organised chaos because it's all just, you know, 300 kids and adults in the church. But it's amazing to see sort of how much that has kind of just become a central part for a lot of people of their Christmas, sort of that's now part of their Christmas tradition, even if they don't really go to church the rest of the time. And that in itself is valuable. We like that. We obviously try to do what we can to reach out to that community in the rest of the year, and we have holiday fun clubs, and we do, you know, a number of other things half the challenge for us, we think, is actually getting people across the threshold of the church and letting them see that it might not be what they thought it was. Because I think a lot of people have preconceptions, and we're in a kind of an area where there's a lot of footfall, lots of people walk past the church. And often once they come inside, they say, oh, I've walked past it many times and I've always wondered what it's like inside. And you give them permission, you give them an excuse to come in. And it often sort of, they suddenly realise, oh, this is a bit different to what I was expecting. And so we've done like lots of events like petting farms and indoor ice rinks and things in our church, which have given, you know, a real invitation to the community to come in. And it's amazing the kind of relationships that start to grow and develop from that. And for us, that's where we've seen a lot of the growth is through kind of doing that and breaking down people's preconceptions by just simply getting them to come across for some reason, and then they realise church isn't as scary as they might have assumed it was.
Okay, so coming to the hard question now. Well, I keep on talking about this a lot. I went to a meeting in January where Brian Cox was speaking, and it was a entirely secular meeting.
Yeah.
And he quoted George Lemaitre, who was a
Catholic priest who came up with the Big Bang
theory. Yeah, the theory of the expansion of the universe. Mm. And so George Lemaitre, answering Einstein, said, there are two paths to truth, and I choose to take them both.
Mm.
So what do you think about the fact that Brian Cox brings that into that sort of setting, is saying about the
I hadn't heard that, but that's so fascinating to hear that he chose to quote Lemaitre in that context. Because I think to some extent, some parts of the humanist community, the atheist community, have tried to co-opt Brian Cox into sort of their science rationalism, therefore no God sort of story. But he seems to have been quite unwilling, actually, to go in that direction. And I've always actually found when he has spoken out in any way on it, he's been quite measured.
Mm.
He hasn't wanted to be a controversialist like some well-known atheist scientists. And he's actually just recently actually done some actual engagement in ways that he hasn't done before with people. So I know he did something up in Durham recently where he was...
Yeah, where he quoted that.
Right. Where he was engaging on the issue of science and faith, and very much, you know, acknowledging that there's a strong tradition there, that there's not being at all dismissive as others would be, and I find that very encouraging and refreshing. I think that's a sensible approach. He obviously doesn't believe himself. I don't think he's ever made any, you know, claim that I think he tends to think of himself as an agnostic, essentially, in this regard. I've tried to have him on my show. I've tried to invite him on my show, and it's never worked out in the past, but I would love to have him on. But I wouldn't be inviting him on as the kind of hard-boiled atheist guest. I think it would be much more a sense of just exploring where he's coming from in terms of where he sees the ground on that front. And if he thinks there's an inkling of a possibility that behind this incredibly, you know, complex, fantastic universe, there might be a mind. Because I have a feeling he's not dismissed that out of hand.
Well, he described that at the meeting that I was at as an elegant answer, which for a physicist to say something's an elegant answer was really interesting. That kind of immediately made me go,
wow.
Because I'd not heard it before.
Yeah, and I can imagine a lot of his more, you know, vehemently atheist colleagues not liking that, you know, because Well, it depends who's quoting them, to be honest, because Christians and atheists can both quote mine their own sources to some extent. Mm. But you do hear, you know, we obviously Stephen Hawking passed away recently, but a lot of the things he was saying later in his life were quite sort of anti-religious in a sense of, you know, he really kind of started to go down a road of saying, no, there's the universe can explain itself. We don't need a God hypothesis or anything like that. So you sort of have people who seem to take a particular stand and decide. But interestingly, I interview a lot of atheist biologists and quite a lot of atheist agnostic physicists. And I tend to find there's a bit more openness among the physicists to God than there is among the biologists. And I sometimes wonder if that's because the biologists sort of look down and the physicists look up. And there's a sort of, there's something about the nature of getting to the boundaries of what we can know, the metaphysical boundary of what we can know that is inevitable when you're looking at the universe, that I think opens up the question. And I think there's a natural sense in which it brings you up against the possibility that there may be more than just this physical universe, because of the nature of the question, you know, the way, the extraordinary bizarre nature of what happens when you get to that very earliest moment of the Big Bang, or what happens in the quantum world, or whatever it is. I think it just makes you realise the truth is stranger than fiction. We live in a bizarre, like when you actually get down to it, it's such a strange world. It makes the God hypothesis not seem that strange after all, almost, if you know what I mean.
I'm going to ask you a strange question, then I'm going to come back to the biologist, because a bit of me is kind of... So, do you think Christians can believe in multiverse theory?
I think they can. I'm open to that, because I think it's an interesting hypothesis. I think if it's true, it does solve some issues in physics. So I don't think Christians should be against it somehow for ideological reasons. If that's where the science is pointing genuinely, I think we should be open to that and so on. I think the concerns some Christians have had who are engaged in this area of physics and faith and everything is that the multiverse hypothesis has sometimes been postulated as a sort of get out of jail card from the implications of the fine-tuning of the universe. And so if we have this extraordinary phenomenon of the fine-tuning of the universe that is so incredibly precisely fine-tuned in all of its fundamental constants and quantities and physical laws to allow for life to develop, and the multiverse hypothesis neatly deals with that by saying, oh, well, if we're just one of a potentially infinite number of universes, all with their own different setups of physics, then we just happen to live in one of them that had the potential to produce life. And I think some Christians have felt that's been postulated as a way of avoiding the God hypothesis, as a way of saying, oh, it wasn't design, it was chance after all, because we're just one in a huge number of universes. Now, if that's the reason people are postulating it, I think that's not science. That's kind of just preferring something over another explanation. But if there is genuine scientific evidence, that could point towards a multiverse. And I think there are some tentative theories out there that do appear to be pointing possibly in that direction. Then I think absolutely we should get on board and we should look into that and say. I don't think it stops the question, because ultimately it won't actually solve, it won't sort of eliminate the God question. A multiverse needs to come from somewhere. A multiverse needs an explanation. A multiverse itself, when I speak to the physicists who are involved in it, without getting into the technicalities of the science, itself would need an incredible amount of fine-tuning to be able to do what it does, essentially, this process of producing a multiverse, if you like. So there's it's all fascinating stuff, and I enjoy looking into it. But I think, yeah, Christians can believe in the multiverse if that's what they think is where science is pointing. I don't think it in any way eliminates God. I'm personally not convinced at this point, from what I have read in the literature and seen. I think there are a number of reasons why it seems unlikely we're just part of the multiverse. And the problem, of course, is that you could never really know in the strict scientific sense, because by definition, any other universe is a separate reality to ours. You won't be able to test it as we can any other scientific hypothesis. It will always, in a sense, remain a hypothetical sort of extrapolation from our physics rather than something we could actually empirically observe, as we do with all the rest of our science. When we want to validate a hypothesis, it's once we've got the empirical observation that we go, ah, we were right. I'm not sure we'll ever be able to do that with a multiverse, is the problem.
Great. Biology. You see, I a bit of me goes, but I'm a biologist, because I was a biochemist for all those years.
Yeah.
But I'm now not quite so sure whether I know more physicists that are Christians or biologists who are Christians, because of course Bishop Lee Rayfield was a molecular biologist as well, and we talk a little bit about that in the interview that I've done with him about how when you move away from your science career into ordained ministry, how people view that and how people respond to that. So,
as in the people who you were with in the scientific community.
So whether how people are thinking that you're throwing your life away and all those sorts
you've given up rational thinking.
Yes.
And so
in it, as an internal ad, if you want to find out more about Bishop Lee and mine's experience of that, go and listen to the podcast with Bishop Lee. I had a very interesting experience with him where we were talking about embryology and about the mouse embryo experiments. And apparently I was the only person who ever got that question right. All the time he ever did, I put up my hand and you get one black and white mouse. And he's like, oh, of course you know, Janet. So the last question on the list is, what is your favourite thing beginning with T?
Ooh, crumbs. Okay. My favourite begin, as in the letter T.
However you want to interpret the question.
I would have to say it's a... I'm trying to think now, what could it be? Sitting down for tea with my family. Because I have four kids and it's quite chaotic very often in our house. But when we get around the table and we have pancakes or waffles or something like that, and we just chat and have fun, that's kind of what makes life worth living. You know, that's when you know that you're in the right place with the kids and wife and enjoying each other's company over some tea.
Thank you very much, Justin. It's been great to have you as an interviewee. So thank you for coming and taking part in the project.
Thank you very much.